YouTube Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 5. J.J. Sefton here with CBD, and joining us once again, our co-blogger and friend, the estimable Joe Mannix. Gentlemen, happy Friday. What's happening, fellas?
Hello, folks.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, whatever's applicable.
Absolutely.
I think we're all three of us are on the eastern side of the country, so yeah. It's either late morning or early afternoon, so we're doing fine. It's a gorgeous early fall day here on the Northeast. It dipped into the 40s last night. I hear the whisper of my steam heat kicking on, just sort of depressing because, of course, the cost for natural gas has tripled in the last 2 years. So I'm expecting some rather painful heating bills in the next several months.
At least you get that nice character of the lovely sound of steam heat. I just have a fan for my forced air, so I don't even get the minor aesthetic upshot.
Yeah, no minor aesthetic upshots here. I'm actually not really in the East, technically. I'm in the upper Midwest now. And it is a beautiful, crisp day here in Wisconsin, which kind of happened overnight. It was like, we got these beautiful mild temperatures here. It's almost sort of felt like, you know, Santa Monica, you know, on a spring day. And then all of a sudden, bam, here we are. I'm wearing my jacket and my cap here, trying not to look like a Jewish cab driver in the middle of southern Wisconsin, but that's failing miserably. Anyway, something that has been on my mind and really has come to the fore because of what's going on with an FBI whistleblower by the name of Steve Friend, who has found himself now, I believe he's out of a job and for literally blowing the whistle on what we've all know has been going on, which is that the FBI is now directly targeting for persecution so-called white supremacists, meaning anybody who is opposed to this regime or who believes, as we all know, that the election was stolen and so on and so forth, as opposed to going after pedophiles. And he has been told, you know, basically the pressure has been put on the agency and on the agents to literally invent cases, even if no cases exist, of so-called white supremacists or white supremacist plots and so on and so forth. And so, you know, we've gone on about how people like Andrew McCarthy and Sean Hannity have been defending the wonderful rank and file of agents that are really there, while people like Christopher Wray or James Comey are, you know, engaged in this horrendous persecution. And we all want to know, well, why do they not walk out en masse? Well, here at least we have an incidence of one individual with a conscience who literally is putting his life on the line by blowing the whistle on the FBI. And it just raises the question, where is everybody else? Why is everybody else not doing it? I mean, is it just a question of getting along in order to protect your pension? Or, you know, at what point do we reach the point where you've got to put it all on the line and risk it, because what's happening what's going to happen is far worse if you don't take a stand.
I think there are two issues here. One, the expectation that people will put everything on the line, I think, is unfounded. You're asking people to behave in a way that simply isn't rational for the vast majority of people. However, the full-throated support of everything the FBI does is something completely different. I think that the rank and file can soft-pedal their resistance to the insanity of the FBI and the politicization of the federal government jackboots. I think that Mr. Friend, or his name is Stephen Friend, has gone above and beyond, and I applaud him for it, and I'm extraordinarily impressed. But if there is some large portion of the FBI and the Justice Department and the other portions of the junta that disagree with the current tone of the United States government, they can do something short of jeopardizing their careers, jeopardizing their retirements, jeopardizing everything. And that's the question, I think. Where are they? Where are those people who are not enthusiastic about these 5 a.m. raids on 65-year-old lawyers who come to the door in their pajamas and a robe? Where is that resistance? And unfortunately, I see very little of that. And I am suspicious that perhaps there isn't some core of the FBI that feels uncomfortable with this behavior, but is unsure what to do.
I think you used an important word there, CBD, because I don't think there is, at least there doesn't appear to be. Believe me, nothing would make me happier than to be proven wrong on this. But there doesn't appear to be a core within the FBI that is uncomfortable with this or understands how sinister and evil this is. There are individuals. Friend comes immediately to mind, and his behavior has been admirable. And the stand that he has taken at great personal cost has been something to look up to, I think. But some of what he's talked about in his disclosures, and I believe it was Miranda Devine's article, is talking with colleagues who are basically in this position of, I know it's wrong. I know this isn't right, but I know I'm being used as a pawn for the games of the politicians above me, yet I'm still doing it. And that's where I have a problem. Where is that soft resistance? Where are the slow walking of processing paperwork? Where is the sort of internal within the bureau sort of Irish democracy? And that's what we're not seeing. And it could be that it is happening and things would be worse if it weren't for those people, but it's all hidden. But you would have to take that as an article of faith. And I'm sort of plumb out of faith when it comes to the FBI. So where is that core of dissent? And I don't think that core of dissent exists. We have a smattering of it here and there, and it's widely distributed, but it's not, I don't think it's really there as a force that can make a difference within the FBI. And I think that's a serious problem.
You know, if you go back now to a few years ago, during the Trump administration, not just the FBI, but, you know, the sort of to underscore your point, Joe, the entire administrative state seemingly did everything in its power, not just the political appointees or whoever, but they did everything in their power to sabotage Donald Trump's agenda at every turn. They actively took a part in Irish democracy, or really just bald-faced insurrection, up until and including the military, where I believe it was generals who were given orders to do certain things in Afghanistan who literally were insubordinate and refused to carry out the orders of the commander-in-chief. So that kind of puts an interesting and alarming counterpoint to what you said, and also underscores the fact that, you know, only one person like Stephen Friend or maybe one or two other people will stand up and blow the whistle on what's going on. Yeah, there are the people who kind of go along to get along or get along to go along to sort of safeguard their careers. But there are, as you said and as CBD said, alarmingly, people who will enthusiastically go ahead and drag Paul Manafort out of his house at 3 a.m. in front of a CNN crew. And at the same time, down the road, if this is not stopped, will drag all of us to, as they did in Germany in the 30s and 40s, Nacht und Nebel, you know, night and fog, and then you just disappear. This is an indicator of where we are heading. I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I give that example, but if people do not stand up and stop this, it's exactly where we're heading.
And I think that's the hope, if there is any, and I'm not sure that I have any, but I sort of hope that I do. But is
hope for hope.
That
I like
guys, guys like Friend and what he's done. If there is, I guess, take a step back. The problem is we know that there are enthusiastic participants in this, and we know that there are reluctant participants in this. What we don't know is who's in the majority and who has the ability to swing the pendulum in their own direction. And what we might see, if we get a great outcome from this, is that because of what Friend has done, it will galvanize those people who are reluctantly going along with it. And if it turns out that they are the real force to be reckoned with, not just within the FBI, but as you alluded to, JJ, within the rest of the administrative state, if those are the guys that there are more of and that can either slow walk, blow the whistle, be willing to lose their jobs to bring it to the fore, or just work, you know, silently within to try to disrupt and halt what's going on, then things might end up swinging a little bit, not completely, back to the direction they need to go. But if those guys who are the reluctant camp are the smaller faction as compared to the enthusiastic camp, then Friend will have ended up being a martyr as opposed to a notable revolutionary.
Unfortunately, I agree. I was hoping to be optimistic in my comments from a few minutes ago, but I think it's probably the majority that is passive participants who are more interested in the career and the pension and the possibly the power of being an FBI or a Justice Department employee.
At the risk of invoking Godwin's law, I just cannot help but thinking about Germany and the German military in the 1930s and 1940s, how they went along with what was going on because, you know, obviously, at least in the beginning, Mr. Schicklgruber was wildly successful. And even those that saw what was happening and saw what was going on, especially after the Russian campaign kicked off, it was kind of too late to do anything. And so you're paralyzed. And so you want to protect, you want to cover your own ass, protect your own ass. But there's nothing that you're going to do. You see it's wrong. And that you know, whatever. Okay, whatever. There's nothing I can do. I'll close my eyes to it. But even though I know what's going on in the background, and I think we're sort of heading in this same direction. And it's poor Joe. He's trying to be optimistic and I'm trying to be optimistic somewhere. But I believe CBD, you may very well be right in that Stephen Friend is turning into more of a martyr than a symbol of a leader of a freedom movement that causes a dam to burst and people just to sort of say no more. But you know something, what will happen or what can happen is as everything around us collapses, I mean, it's easy to sort of to take that stand in a way to go along to cover your ass when everything is going well, when you have something to protect, when you have a pension, when you have a home, when you have a life. But when all of this collapses because of a collapsing economy and societal dissolution, then, you know, as I said this morning, as Dylan said, when you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing left to lose. You know, God help us if we ever reach that point when people become suddenly brave enough, then they'll get a backbone when there's nothing left. And that's kind of a frightening prospect.
The Nazi analogy is unfortunately correct. Everybody knows Hannah Arendt and her discussion about the banality of evil. But what she meant by that, I think, speaks quite well to our current situation. And I think she talked about people who, they don't make their minds up to be good and they don't make their minds up to be evil. They just sort of go along with the flow. And if the flow is Eichmann, you know, creating a state that is absolutely focused on the destruction of the Jewish people, then they'll go along with that. And I see that in the FBI more than I see the decision to be good. The decision that Stephen Friend made just recently, he decided to be good. And for that, he deserves our support. Anyway, we'll move off the Nazi topic for a bit.
The parallels that you and CBD, you and JJ mentioned are there. I think there is another thing to consider, and it's out of another totalitarian system, which was Russia. And a lot of what we're seeing today, it also has parallels with what Solzhenitsyn has described. And this, I guess, sort of the motivator for what Friend has done with his whistleblowing is you could have taken it right out of the Soviet playbook in that they're saying, we're going to take you off of whatever you were working on, and we're going to put you on white supremacy. And we see this in the press. There's white supremacy everywhere. It's the white supremacist and the ethno-staters and whatever else that is the great risk to the land. But you probably don't know any white supremacists because there effectively aren't any white supremacists. Yes, they exist, right? No matter what, they will. But it's not a serious problem, and certainly not a serious problem in terms of organization. If we take the two biggest white supremacist organizations in this country, which are the Aryan Brotherhood and the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Brotherhood almost doesn't matter because it's almost entirely an institutional population already, right? They recruit and thrive in our prisons. But if we put both of those groups together, according to their membership or population estimates, it's like 25,000 people. In a nation of 350 million. So let's assume that that 25,000 people number is off by a lot. Let's say it's four times greater than that, five times greater than that. We're looking at the aggressive, enthusiastic, down with the cause white supremacists in this country would not fill LSU's Tiger Stadium. This is a non-problem. This problem doesn't exist. But all of a sudden, it's everywhere in all of the newspapers. It's the biggest threat to the state, and the organs of state security must go and address that problem. And Solzhenitsyn talked about this fairly extensively, and it's exactly what we're seeing with this white supremacist nonsense. I suspect we would find parallels to other varieties of totalitarianism, whether it was Pol Pot in Cambodia or Mao or Xi, because totalitarians are more alike than they are different. And so the parallels make themselves incredibly evident. And what Friend has done is really helped to expose that, because I didn't know before his disclosure, and it might be that I was tuned out because I've been very busy in the last several months, I didn't know that the FBI was making this full pivot toward white supremacy at the expense of all else. And that makes zero sense when you consider how many actual white supremacists we have in this country. It's a rounding error. It's a rounding error on a rounding error of the population of this country.
Let's accept your number of four times the stated membership of those two organizations. Let's accept 100,000 people in the United States who were enthusiastic white supremacists. Would you argue with me if I said that I could, in a few months, find 1 million hard left people in this country who are enthusiastic supporters of the most virulent Stalinist techniques to crush the right. Would that surprise you?
That wouldn't surprise me, because they're probably, you know, most of them are being, they're in the universities and then are our schools. A lot of them are even in our government. My God. And just to circle back for a moment to what Joe was saying is that you assume it's 100,000. Let's say it's 100,000. OK, how many of those 100,000 are and they're crazy and rabid and nuts? How many of those 100,000 are actually willing to put together a pipe bomb or go machine gun a softball game, a Democrat softball game, or run somebody down in a car because President Trump said that left-wing Maoists are the greatest threat to American society? And they are the greatest threat to American society, but we've never mowed anybody down in an automobile. And if anybody did that, we would abhor it, and we would condemn it immediately. But as far as left-wing, well, look at BLM, look at Antifa. We don't know how many are in these organizations, and for sure they have proven themselves to be violent because they set fire to America in the summer of 2020 and burned scores of American inner cities to the ground just on the notion that a criminal named George Floyd died while he was being arrested. However, he was being arrested, after the act of resisting arrest. So please tell me again, where is the real threat? But of course, that's why I would not be surprised, because not only are they there, we've seen them do their worst. They've caused billions of dollars in damage and destruction just in one summer alone.
Move on to the next topic, which is the delightful svelte Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and her equally delightful comments about the existence or non-existence of the fetal heartbeat. The conventional wisdom has been that the fetal heartbeat appears at around 5 or 6 weeks after conception, and she apparently, in her role as both a candidate for governor and a developmental biologist, has decided that is simply an artifact of the testing. And so that's the current anti-life stand for the next week or so.
I might be misreading or misjudging Stacey Abrams, and I'll be upfront about that. I don't know her, but she strikes me as quite stupid and quite useful in terms of left-wing agitation. But she didn't, where I'm going with that is she didn't make this crap up. This is coming out of, like we saw in some of the tweets around this topic, that, at 5 to 6 weeks, we can detect the electrical activity in the heart, but it doesn't make a sound. That sound is being synthetically generated, and it is not real. And we can't really detect valve motion using other imaging or listening techniques until about 13 weeks. And so it's not really a heartbeat because there's no blood moving through valves yet. And she then distills that into its incredibly stupid essence and takes it out on a roadshow. But that argument is, one, it throws into question rather a lot about what's real, just sort of in a broad scope of things. If you watch a program on television or read text on a website, then that is not the actual people. And it is not the actual words. Those are just electronic representations of it. They're created by the machinery. So by this standard, virtually nothing in our world and literally everything in the virtual world is fake. But setting the obvious problems with that aside, this is the kind of false equivalence and getting caught up in minutiae and applying levels of technical detail that aren't really necessary to actually answer the broader question, in order to evade the broader question. It's profoundly dishonest, and it's a way of deflecting what they actually want to be known for or what they actually want to talk about. And that, I don't know if that is because they think they're putting one over on us, as in their audience. And for some people, it will probably work. I don't know if they're trying to lie to us or if they're trying to lie to themselves. I think they're probably trying to lie to us, and they hold us in utter contempt. When I see an argument like this getting caught up in meaningless technical minutiae in order to obscure the actual point that's being discussed, the argument is as offensive as what it's arguing for.
All it is to me is them. There's two things. One, they're doing this scientific gibberish mumbo jumbo just so that they can move the goalposts. That's number one. And the reason they do that is because as science becomes even more advanced, and just, you know, take religion or morality or whatever it is out of the equation for a moment, as we become more advanced, we're confirming the fact that at earlier and earlier stages that a fetus or an unborn baby, or however you want to define a prenatal individual in the womb, is really more and more formed and more human and can feel pain and all of these sort of things, and is more closer to a human being than a protoplasm than we had first believed. And this really counters, it really stands and it makes a very strong argument that if abortion shouldn't be outlawed completely, then it should certainly be limited, and much more limited than it has been in the past, or what we thought we should limit it to in the past. That's all this is.
Hold on one second. Let's go to the United States government as the final arbiter of what is occurring at 5 to 6 weeks. This is from Medline, which is a .gov site. It's simply they take the most obvious and accepted research, and they distill it into pages based on topic. Week five, your baby's brain, spinal cord, and heart begin to develop. Week six and seven, baby's heart continues to grow and now beats at a regular rhythm. This can be seen by vaginal ultrasound. Blood pumps through the main vessels. Well, at week six to seven, that means your baby's heart is pumping. At week five, sure, we can discuss it, but let's accept Stacey Abrams' argument and say at week six, the heart is pumping. Okay, well, that means that's a human being. So let us restrict abortion to the first 5 weeks. Well, that's acceptable to me, because in reality, abortion will always exist in the United States, and the insanity of third trimester abortions is what has exercised most people and has offended most people. But if we back it down to up to week five, it's fine with me. I'm not going to argue that point.
And I think it's because you might not argue that point, CBD, that they need to keep pushing for it. And this ties into what JJ just said. If the argument is around, say, the heartbeat, then by removing the heartbeat from the equation, suddenly it doesn't matter anymore. If the question is viability, which has also come up in this post-Roe snit that people have been in, then if you can define viability up or down, then you can move the goalposts again. By removing these arguments from the table, by saying the heartbeat isn't the heartbeat, or viability isn't viability, whatever is the preferred argument of whoever is trying to advance the cause, by on either side, by the way, if you remove that point from the argument, then you're left with no position at all. And I think that might very well be what they're working toward. And why I think the better answer to this, and the more they do that, the more likely it becomes a binary choice, which is, well, if we don't know what it is, and we can't define it, and we can't time it, and we can't track it, because there is no reality anymore, then it becomes a binary question of yes or no at any time, which makes the fight that much harder to win. And that very well might be the purpose. And the best reaction I can think of to arguments like Stacey Abrams and her buddies in the abortion doctoring community are making is take your technical minutia and cram it. Not interested.
Exactly.
We know. It is what it is. So shut the hell up. I'm not listening to you. We're going to continue trying to accomplish our goal. And if that's what CBD said, fine. If it's more restrictive or less restrictive, there's a reason we're having an argument about it. But the correct response to people trying to completely disrupt that argument and remove its parameters through a bunch of nonsense is just to tell them to shut the hell up and disregard them.
I'm going to
very, very big mistake here, because she did draw that line at week five. I think it was week five. And that can be refuted. She has in the past been very good at obfuscating and avoiding significant and realistic comments. She really hasn't said that her last election was stolen from her. She intimates it. She hints at it. She beats around the bush, but she doesn't say it straight out. But this time she said it straight out, and it can be refuted. But even I understand Joe Manix's point that we should just tell them to stick it, that this is a life at the moment of conception. And if you want to destroy it, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about you making murder okay. But I really don't think that abortion is ever going to be eliminated in the United States.
That wasn't precisely what I meant, CBD. So I guess, if I may, I'd like to.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm making a larger point, and that is that at some point we have to accept that there will be some abortion. And if we can back it down to a point at which most people accept it as, you know, women's health, or we're not so sure what's going on right now, then I think that we should probably declare victory at that point. I think that the 15 weeks, the 20 weeks, the 25 week limits are offensive in the extreme. And if we can push them off those points, then we will have to accept that as a victory.
Well, here's the thing. They will not accept anything, literally. I mean, their own phrase is something, some repulsive thing like unafraid, unapologetic, abortion, no questions, no nothing. One of Obama's science advisors, maybe it was John Holdren or somebody, he even postulated at one point that a human being is not even fully developed until he's 2 years old, which means post, you know, what's that, the 12th trimester? My math is shoddy. That's insane. So the left does not want to compromise, period, end of story. I mean, from an anecdotal story of my own, my cousin gave birth I believe it was maybe four months or 5 months, what's that, 16 or 20 weeks, and the child was frail, was weak, was probably not going to make it, but it was fully formed. It was there. You know, it was a frail little girl, and they did everything they could to try to save that girl's life. And in the end, she didn't make it more than a couple of weeks, and she was given a decent burial and a headstone. So for them to do this is heinous in the extreme. So there won't be any compromise. They want it. They want to be able to kill a baby anytime and for any reason whatsoever. And I'll go even further. I'll risk, you know, Godwin's law once again, or totalitarian's law. The reason that they do this is that when you dehumanize, when you define a human being, even one that's unborn, it's just merely a clump of cells, a mistake, a tumor, or whatever you want to call it, it allows them to commit murder without having to call it murder. It's easy for them to take life because it's not really life. And this is the same way they dehumanize their political enemies, by calling us every name in the book and short of being subhuman. I mean, where have we heard this before? Makes it very easy and to look the other way and say, well, it's got to be done so that society, so that we can save our precious democracy, quote unquote, from elements that want to kill us. So this is all part and parcel of this culture of death, this party of death, these godless heathens who just want absolute power and will stop at nothing to get it.
There is, if I can offer something of a counterpoint, because I think you're absolutely right, JJ, that the left is never going to accept any restriction at all. But one of the big open questions, and we see it debated constantly, is how big is that actual radical left? They control all the institutions. That much is unquestionable, I think. But are they actually a majority or a powerful enough plurality? And by being willing to compromise along the lines that CBD was talking about, say it's 5 or 6 weeks, and you can, whether it's at heartbeat or not, and that was more my point, CBD, is to reject their sub-argument about heartbeat and just hold whatever your original point was, because they're absurd and provably absurd, is if most people are willing to have a compromise at 6 weeks or 10 weeks or whatever it turns out to be, whether you want to keep moving after that is achieved. But if you're, it is somewhat beside the point, but if you're able to achieve that as sort of the normal response, then that would be a brutal defeat, I think, for that hard left, because the hard left, yes, wants zero compromise. They want abortion up to the moment of birth, if not even after it, like Governor Northam was talking about. But if you can get that norm to shift away from them and take the control of that argument away from them, that's a pretty big deal. Or I think it might be a pretty big deal. So one potential counterargument to that, which is being willing to compromise on the topic, even if you view it only as a middle step toward your final goal, might do rather a lot to disempower a fairly important faction within the hard left.
Interesting. I have nothing to say. I apologize. You make a lot of sense.
I could just conclude by saying, again, whether it's abortion or any issue, they do not want to compromise. And I think if they even did, for them even to compromise, let's take a little higher level view of everything, of the gestalt, if you will, of everything. If they were to compromise, it would be admitting, or de facto admitting, that those that you are compromising with are not the evil, knuckle-dragging, racist, terroristic criminals, you know, that you have been portraying since time immemorial. And it gives our side a legitimacy that they never want to give it to us, because that stands in the way of them attaining absolute power, because our worldview is antithetical to their worldview. And the only thing that they can do is to wipe us out, whether it's abortion, whether it's any issue, whether it's how government is to be structured, what is law and order, what is a family, what is you name it. They will never compromise with us on anything, because we are a nemesis that has to be wiped out.
And of course, and let's be honest about this. They don't give a shit about women's health. They don't give a shit about abortion. What they are doing is desensitizing the American people to the murder of human beings. And I apologize, we're invoking Godwin's law again. You know, you go back to the 1930s, and one of the first things that the Nazi Party did when they took power was to start pushing the essentially the euthanasia of the infirm, of the, you know, the retarded, the frail, the people on the fringes of society who were not productive members of that society. And it's, you know, it's pretty easy to convince somebody who is comfortable with late-term abortion that, well, you know, the two-year-old with terrible cerebral palsy, you know, significant retardation, he'll never have a job, he'll never be able to speak, blah, 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 blah. Let's just put him out of his misery. Well, you start expanding that, and all of a sudden, you've got concentration camps, and 6 million Jews are dead. That is the goal, and the desensitization of the American people to the sanctity of human life is that goal. And anybody who claims that is not the point is disingenuous.
You have just crystallized my blathering for several minutes down into a very succinct and wonderful point. That is exactly what they need to do. Thank you for that.
Okay, well, let's hold that thought. I love ending on a high note. Let's take a short break, and we will come back with the economy.
We are back, CBD, J.J. Sefton here, along with our guest this week, Joe Mannix. Gentlemen, I think CBD left us with another wonderful nugget that we're going to get into, is our economy. We're dying out here. Someone throw us a line, please. We're being killed, actually, more being smothered with a My Pillow by Sponge Brain Shits Pants and his company. Unbelievable.
The news this week, there were two pieces of news I think are important. One is the Fed's GDP Now model. I think that's run out of the Atlanta Fed. And the other was also out of the Federal Reserve, which was the interest rate rise. So I think a lot of people, at least in the capital markets, were hoping we weren't going to get another 0.75 point rise. Well, we got another 0.75 point rise. And in my opinion, this is all not moving fast enough. But the Fed is holding its own line that until inflation is under control, the interest rates will keep rising. And they seem to have settled on 0.75% increases to the prime rate. And they're doing that every quarter. And that will likely continue, which has lots of implications for the capital markets, you know, stocks, stock markets, bond markets, real estate. But then out of the Atlanta Fed, their GDP Now forecast, and the GDP Now is an interesting model because it's semi-real time. It brings in data and it builds its prediction for what the current quarter's GDP growth is going to be when the final number is actually calculated. It has a mixed history of reliability, but one of the things that is interesting about it is that if you track that figure from the beginning of the quarter to the end, as more data become available, it tends to hone in more accurately on what the final number is going to be. And while the final number isn't always all that accurate, its direction more often is. And so what we saw at the beginning of the quarter was GDP now was predicting, you know, 2% growth. And as of this week, it's reported it's predicting like 0.3% growth, which is a tremendous downward movement as more data have become available. And so what that implies is the more we know, the worse it looks. We also had the inflation number last week, week before, coming in hot. It's year over year inflation is still up. Month over month inflation is up. Their attempt to spin the story last month that inflation is now zero has the narrative is completely broken down on that. The only silver lining that can be found that I can see is that gas prices are still lower than they were when everybody was dying because of it. They're moving back up, at least sporadically, and gas prices aren't down because we have great production. It's down because demand has been being destroyed. But and that's the only
out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Yep. And eating our seed grain.
Still enough.
Yep. And the combination of all of this, and then if we look at retail, lot of inventory just not moving. So in Q4 of last year, we had that gangbusters GDP print. It looked wonderful until you peered inside of it and saw that it was almost all inventory build. And almost all of that new inventory that was being built up was to recover from the depletion during COVID and to prepare for the coming economic recovery. Well, the coming economic recovery has not come. And so there are still really, really high inventories. And we have stories of enterprises like, I forget whether it was Walmart or Target, having to build like temporary on-site warehouses in some of the cities that they service because there's inventory that's just not moving, which it is looking like a lot of bad news. And winter is right around the corner. And bluntly, I'm sort of profoundly worried about what that is going to look like and what that's going to mean for people who have to work for a living, not to mention various international events. But the economic data that we see is all bad. And the economic story we are being told on the nightly news and by Obama's laughable press secretary, Biden's laughable press secretary. is that happy days are here again. Inflation is contained. Gas prices are low. Everything is wonderful. And we have all the money in the world to spend on anything that we want. And we've seen bad economies before, and we've seen lying government before, and we've seen governments lying about bad economies before, but I've never seen it at this scale. What we're being told has now at this point actually nothing to do with the reality. And I find that sort of fascinating.
Let's talk about that reality. You mentioned earlier the trend, which seems to be a 0.75% increase every quarter or every meeting, which is, I think, five times a year. I'm not sure exactly what that is. And let's go back to what the Fed feels is reasonable inflation, which is, I think, between 1% and 2%. That has always been their goal, or has been their goal in the modern era. And if we're looking at what is realistically a 10% inflation rate, and the Fed rate is now what, 3.25%? I'm guessing, but it's around there. So they have 7% to go, minus 1% or 2%. So let's say they have 5% to go. That's a couple of years, and that means a couple of years of regular increases in the interest rate. And the problem with that is that as you increase the interest rate, you tamp down economic growth. And the Fed used to have the ability to decrease the rate to pump up growth. But we can't do that now because we've already pumped several trillion dollars into the economy. And that has to sort of filter its way out before we can do anything else other than raise interest rates. So the idea that this recession is going to be short is a pipe dream. And the idea that it's going to be mild is a pipe dream. We are looking at, and I'm guessing, but I think we're looking at least another year to 2 years of recession in the United States.
And at least that much of inflation. Remember, inflation is a lagging indicator. So even once we tame the beast, it'll still take another half a year before the problems really start going away. And it, in part, the use of interest rates as a stimulus tool get less and less valuable as you approach zero, right? Because as much as nobody likes to think about it, zero is a real thing. And we've been zero bounded for a really, really long time. And the key problem, I think, because we've been playing these interest rate games for a very long time. Alan Greenspan started it in the wake of 9/11 and helped to deliver us the housing bubble. And then Ben Bernanke, and then I think Janet Yellen was next, continued the trend after the financial crisis. And a lot of people, myself included, when the zero interest rate stuff started about 2010, were talking about this is going to cause a lot of inflation. And in the end of the day, I was wrong, sort of. I mean, I was wrong in the everyday terms. Where we did see a lot of inflation was in the capital markets, in assets, right? Bonds were not worth much because of the inflation. Stocks went crazy. Real estate went crazy. But the inflation was contained to those areas where the Fed was manipulating the money supply. Where I think we made a tremendous error was during COVID, we played the same games of generating vast amounts of new debt to go out and masquerade as money, but it wasn't contained anymore. It wasn't just sitting in the capital markets causing them to inflate away. It was everywhere. They did the helicopter drops. Everybody got their Trump bucks and their Biden bucks in the mail, and the money sluiced around the economy to a much greater degree than it did during like quantitative easing. And they've lost control of it. And I don't think it's about preventing a recession at this point. If it is, then the people trying to accomplish that goal are fools. And I don't think Jerome Powell is a fool. He might be too political and he might be any number of other things, but I don't think he's stupid. And I think that what they're trying to do now, and they might even succeed at it, is try to prevent a total crash and just let it grind downward. But by doing that, we are sure to elongate the duration. So I agree. I think we're in for a very rough few years, but I think they're trying to prevent an outright crash. And so they'll allow it to grind down over a much longer period of time. So time will tell. I could be wrong again. I'm wrong more often than I'm right. But that's that would be my guess based on what we know now.
My limited knowledge of economics, I mean, a lot of this is driven, of course, intentionally by the fact that they are trying to destroy, and they are doing a very damn good job of destroying the fossil fuel industry to chase this green dream. And everything either runs on oil, is made of oil, uses oil, needs oil. And as I've always said, and I want to frickin', you know, if I had a tattoo or if I had a t-shirt, it's, you know, carbon is life. There is no, you cannot get rid of carbon. CO2 is life-giving. To try to get rid of it is a fool's errand, and it's insanity, and it will lead to the dark ages.
Yes, but if we would, that's an excellent, excellent point. And and petroleum is vital. And the reason it is vital is that it is an opportunity to stop pumping money into the economy and start pumping wealth. There's a difference between creating trillions of dollars at the stroke of a key in the Fed and actually pumping wealth out of the ground and injecting it into the economy. And that is what petroleum does to an economy. It is pure wealth. There is nothing complicated about the idea of extracting wealth from the ground and disseminating it throughout the economy.
And energy in particular is also, it's profoundly important in general, but it also has the unusual consequence. Unlike a lot of stuff, you know, if you start seeing reduced production or increased prices in, say, truck axles, that takes a long, much longer time to filter its way out into the wider economy. Energy moves fast because everything uses it, and we use a lot of it, and we use it constantly. And so the consequences on inflation with energy, and as well as on, you know, everything else that you've talked about, our quality of life and our life as we know it, cannot be overstated. And this is why there's this canard going around, and we see it through trolls on AOS. We see it in various articles of the more intellectual class, that it's wrong to blame Joe Biden for the inflation because Donald Trump did all of this spending too. And that's true. It's true to a point. Yes, if Trump had not had an election taken from him and he were still president, we would still have inflation today. You cannot do what we did during COVID and not pay the price for it. But it would not be as severe, and it certainly would not go on for as long as it's going to go on, because Trump would not be out there compounding it at every turn. So Joe Biden took what Trump did and then doubled down on it with even more COVID bucks. We passed that preposterous infrastructure deal. We've passed the appalling Green New Deal deal. Thanks, Joe Manchin. We're spending money like water. And importantly, Biden has done two other things that aren't directly related to spending, which are crippling our energy output, as JJ mentioned, and he's reinstating the pieces of the regulatory regime that Trump had been rolling back and would have continued to roll back. So business is now harder. The conduct of business is now more expensive. Energy is more scarce and therefore more expensive. We're still spending lots and lots of money we don't have. And all of that is being compounded on the catastrophically stupid decisions that we as a country made during COVID. And all of that other stuff, other than those catastrophically stupid COVID decisions, all of that rests firmly at the feet of Joe Biden and his administration. And so to argue we would still have inflation if it weren't for Joe, while that may be true, you have to disregard everything that has happened since January of 2021, and you have to discount the idea that severity and duration matter. And energy is a huge piece of what Joe Biden has done that has made this worse.
And this is all intentional. I mean, this is all, I mean, you want to call it a tinfoil hat conspiracy? Go right ahead. But it's not. It's out in the open. We have the World Economic Forum and the Davos set and the whole global resetters who are openly boasting now of the fact that they want to intentionally destroy the middle class, which is the fuel that drives a prosperous society like the United States. They want to intentionally destroy us and take us back in time so that, for whatever their reasons are, mostly it's just power, of course, so that they can have their private jets and their yachts and so on and so forth, while the rest of us shiver in the dark and slave away somewhere, I would say in a coal mine, but thank you, Joe Manchin, we won't have coal anymore, doing whatever it is to keep their lifestyle up, while most of us either die of starvation, die off in the world, and Mother Earth is rid of the disease known as humanity, while our betters, so-called, lord over us. And this is done intentionally. Yeah. It's to remake society in their image, so that they can accrue power and just wipe us out, period.
I think that's a piece of it. And I think the WEF will ultimately, don't know when, is going to be in for a very nasty shock, because what they want is impossible. They want a new system that looks a little bit like some older systems, where you have your ruling class and then a layer of engineers underneath them that help keep the wheels turning, and then the vast masses who live in their pods and eat their bugs and hang out in the metaverse. It's not going to work. It's never worked, and they can dress it up in all the high tech they want, but it will fail. And that's mighty cold comfort, because if they get their way and then fail, it doesn't mean that I'm not dead. But
you see, I told you so, yeah. From the comfort of a mass grave. There it is.
That's right. At least I can have a good hearty laugh at them from hell.
Yeah. Well, you'll be in heaven. They're going to go to hell. Bargain, bargain. Anyway, let's take a little bit of a break. We'll be back. JJ Sefton, CBD Joe Mannix, Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, back in a flash.
Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, Season 2, Episode 5. J.J. Sefton had to step out as a squirrel that he used to chase off his lawn. But we are here with Joe Mannix, and the next topic is the interesting and actually, frankly, scary escalation in Ukraine.
Yeah, so we've seen some of the reports this week Some are speculative, some are not. So what doesn't appear to be speculative is Russia instituting a draft, which is a pretty big deal, I would say. And then some of the speculative pieces around Russian chain of command disconnect, differing objectives, north or south, lack of cohesion. Don't know if any of that's true, but it's all been speculated about. But it does look like the Russians are not, it's obviously at this point not going according to their original ambitions. I don't imagine that even a country with a very strong central power base like they have in Russia would want to get to the point of having to institute a draft. That strikes me as an acknowledgement that things haven't gone well. There's been a lot of speculation. Well, they expected a long war. They expected a blitzkrieg. Everything's broken. Everything's going swimmingly. The reality, as it always is probably somewhere in the middle. But I don't see the reinstituting of a draft as anything other than an acknowledgement that this has gone fairly wrong for Russia. Now, I do think that if they are successful in being able to raise their men and get them to the front and keep them armed, that Russia will be ultimately successful with whatever it chooses to say was always its goal in Ukraine. But the amount of extra pressure that this is going to cause on Ukraine itself, especially as winter sets in, on Europe, again, especially as winter sets in, as their ability to get Russian energy is clearly not going to be altered. It's not going, that situation is not going to get better by a dramatic escalation. And the fact that if things go really quite wrong, Russia is still a nuclear power. So the escalations this week haven't exactly filled me with good feelings about the potential for the next 6 months. I'll put it that way. CBD, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I'm not particularly afraid of a nuclear exchange. Well, not a nuclear exchange, but the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. I think that Putin is an authoritarian. I think he's lost his perspective, but I don't think that he is insane. And I don't think that he sees the use of nuclear weapons as anything other than a threat. That being said, it's very, very difficult for me to understand what is going on in Ukraine, because the Ukrainians have clearly won the internet battle. They control the narrative. They're very, very good at using the social networks to manipulate the flow of information. Russia is absolutely losing that part of it. Everything they say seems ham-handed. The news out of Moscow sounds ridiculous. That being said, Russia is a much, much bigger country than Ukraine, and they have a minimally capable army. They're not doing very well, obviously, but eventually they are going to win in Ukraine. Whether that happens in a month or 6 months or 6 years, I don't know. My prediction is it's going to take a couple of years, which bodes ill for the world economy. It bodes ill for, as you point out, the use of nuclear weapons, because as it gets worse and worse and worse, the temptation grows to end it quickly. Although how that works, I am not so sure. Where would they launch these nuclear weapons? At large concentrations of Ukrainian soldiers? Possibly. At their biggest cities? Unlikely. So I'm not really sure what the use would be.
Yeah, neither am I. And I don't think that going nuclear is imminent, but it's one of those risks you have to keep in the back of your mind, I think, because if things get desperate, then desperate measures start looking more reasonable. But there is also the possibility, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is what ends up happening in some way, of a non-military conclusion to this saga, as opposed to Russia having to win the war with Ukraine. If Europe gets desperate enough to lift the sanctions and come back to the table to turn on their Russian fuel that they're so dependent on, that would leave Ukraine not quite naked, but close. If the food supply problems that are going to be coming probably by the springtime and compounding from there continue to get bad enough, then the pressure might go on Ukraine to find a way to settle it. Ukraine and Russia both are agriculturally very, very important, especially in some key commodities. Cooking oil is one. There might be other factors at play that mean that there is now enough pressure to find a way to end the military conflict so that the flow of energy and food can resume. that it forces a settlement. Whether that also involves face saving, who knows? And I don't know that's what's going to happen, but I do think that it's a possibility, especially if the military conflict is ramping up in a significant new engagement.
Yeah, it looks like it's become quite the slog. You know, it's interesting that the Ukraine, that their casualty lists are quite small. I don't believe that at all. The Russians say that they've lost about 6,000 people. I doubt that too. U.S. military is guessing that it's that number is off by a factor of 10, I think. That's a lot of men. And that certainly is part of the explanation for the protests occurring in Russia right now. Whether those protests are driven by a few thousand extraordinarily disgruntled and unhappy people, or is it a popular uprising? I don't know. I doubt that it's a popular uprising. I think that there are large minorities in Russia who are supportive of Putin. The Russian psyche has always gravitated toward the strong man, and Putin has done nothing but burnish that image of a strong man for years and years and years.
Yeah,
I hope you're correct that there is a non-military resolution, and I hope it happens very, very soon.
Time will tell. Like I said, it's sort of just my speculation. Whatever it is, I don't think it's going to be soon. You know, I guess time will tell. But in a way, this is we're all having to get used to sort of the way the world used to be, where we have Russia as an enigma, and where everything to do with Russia or Ukraine, in this case, simply because Ukraine happens to be where the engagement is a pack of lies. Nobody really knows much. And as you mentioned, the Ukraine has certainly been dominant in the information battle. No question in my mind of that. But we're sort of going back to the old days of the Soviet Union, where we're in this position of sitting back and doing guesswork, because none of the information can be trusted from any source. And that's, I don't want to say refreshing, but it is at least different.
Well, you know, we're back to the 1970s and 80s.
Yep. Oh,
very exciting. Yeah. Well, speaking of a popular uprising, there are some interesting developments in Iran. A few weeks ago, a woman was arrested by the religious police, and apparently her horrible crime was not wearing a head covering, or perhaps showing her ankles. I don't recall the details, but they beat this young woman to death. And the Iranian people were quite offended by that. There have been protests, violent protests. I know that a couple of days ago, six people were killed in one of these protests. And then I've seen a report in which about 25 people were killed in a large city outside of Tehran. The mullahs are getting, I think, a little bit concerned that their unbelievable authoritarian state is maybe getting a little creaky, and the people of Iran are just a little tired of living under these maniacs for 40 years.
The problem, as I see it, is that there is a great and wonderful thing that the mullahs can depend on, which is on the United States to bail them out. And that's what I fear is going to happen. We've gotten to this kind of thing happening in Iran before. And I think a lot of it is a lot like our hardline leftism that dominates our culture and institutions. There's only so much patience for that kind of thing if you're starving and out of work and going to lose your home. Whether people like it or not, and I would guess that most people probably don't like it very much, but they'll go along with it, because why rock the boat? Things aren't actually all that bad. And yeah, this sucks, but we can get through it. But the amount of tolerance for things like their morality police and the aggressive suppression of any and all dissent, especially when it's stuff that seems like it's probably not all that important, like a woman behaving immodestly by the standards of those morality police, is the tolerance for that gets a lot smaller if you're cold and hungry, and especially if you're cold and hungry and homeless, and especially if you see no hope for that getting any better. And a lot of the economic pressure that the Trump administration had been putting on Iran was the kind of thing that leads to internal revolution if you can keep it up for long enough, if you can afford to as the person doing it. And we saw this happen before during the Obama administration, and then out of the ether comes a massive bailout for their buddies in Iran in the form of the nuclear deal. And what we see now is just as the discussion about getting a new version of the Iran nuclear deal put back into place under Biden after Trump did the unthinkable and canceled it, it's going to give them, and I think that it's going to happen, by the way. I think the Biden administration is going to succeed in that. It's going to give the mullahs another lifeline, because it's going to mean massive infusions of cash, which can help the Iranian regime hold at bay the kind of conditions that make it more worth it for people to start questioning that regime or acting against it. Yeah. So it's, does Iran need a revolution? Well, from a human standpoint, you know, human rights, I think that they do, but they're not going to get one if people are kept fed. And that is a fairly brutal way to look at it. I'll acknowledge that, but we're going to hand them the means to continue. Joe Biden is going to hand it to them on a silver platter and probably on a few more pallets stacked with cash taken to Tehran in the middle of the night, which disgusts me for a number of reasons.
I agree 100%. In fact, I wrote exactly that yesterday on Ace of Spades. And what's sad is that, as I wrote it, it's the perfect time to support the anti-government protesters in Iran. You know, the danger to the mullahs is significant right now. And you're 100% correct that we are going to hand them a lifeline. And I think that the reason for that is twofold. One, there is institutional anti-Semitism and anti-Israel feeling in the State Department and among the holdovers from the Obama administration, the people who are actually running the Biden junta. And also, this is their real politic, trying to create a strong Iran as a foil against Israel in the region. The problem of that, of course, as you just explained, is that they're a bunch of fucking maniacs. And along with a powerful Iran, we arrive at the rather unpleasant idea of a nuclear exchange in the Middle East. Now, it won't come to that because Israel and increasingly, Saudi Arabia and a few of the other Arab countries, the Sunni countries in the Gulf, will attack Iran, either overtly or, as they are doing right now, covertly. But the danger is significant. And the idea that the Biden administration is going to hand the mullahs a lifeline is, as you described, disgusting. This is a clear foreign policy failure on the part of the United States, and one that is easily fixed. It would take a day, you know, an announcement from some functionary in the State Department that, you know, because of the length and the failures of the current negotiations with reinstating the Iranian nuclear deal, we are suspending the discussions. And that's it. And it would end. But they can't do that because they don't want that to happen.
No, they don't. They want a strong Iran. The globalist folks, and this is part of the WEF scheme. I don't know if they came up with it, but they've talked about it enough, is, you know, this vision of a multipolar world that they have has Iran as the top dog in that region. They want Iran to be the star around which the rest of the region orbits. I don't know why they chose Iran instead of Iraq or Saudi Arabia, but they did. And Iran must be protected. And I don't know the deep inner workings of that, but the decision has clearly been made. The chips are all down on Iran, and we're going to do whatever we can to protect Iran while saying that we're not, in order to try to massage the PR around it. But it truly is revolting. Iran is not just run by madmen with obvious nuclear ambitions. It's not just run by religious fanatics. The Iranians make the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia look sane. You know, the Iranian ruling class, their system, their version of that system. It's like we've gotten into bed with the worst version of this, second only maybe to the Taliban. Who we're also getting back in bed with. But it's truly dumbfounding and appalling. And it's going to work. I think Iran is going to get through this just fine, and we're going to do it for them.
Well, with that cheery note, another podcast is reaching its conclusion. Folks, thank you very, very much for listening. So for J.J. Sefton and for Joe Mannix, we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all.